The private equity world is evolving at an unprecedented pace, presenting both challenges and opportunities for investors and companies. In this episode of the Privately Speaking podcast, join KPMG partner and host Erica Whitmore as she talks with Brent Alvord, Managing Director at Sweetwater Private Equity, to discuss the key trends shaping the industry, from the impact of AI to the importance of product discipline and what it means for the future of investing.
Well, Brent, super excited to have you on the Privately Speaking podcast today. I think the listeners will really enjoy everything that you have to say. You and I met at our Growth Capital Conference, which so thankful you were able to attend. Can't wait to have that conference again next year. But you were nice enough to agree to come and talk a little bit about not only yourself, but also Sweetwater. With that, why don't you give us just a little bit of kind of your background so the listeners have that perspective?
Yeah, my name's Brent Alvord. I run research and origination for Sweetwater Private Equity, which is you can think about us at the growth stages of a firm where we enter most of our investments by purchasing shares of other prior investors and companies. Also, about 30% of the fund is available for primary capital as well. So you can think about us like a pretty flexible form of capital across later stage growth, venture growth, as well as growth equity and buyout firms.
Awesome. Well, Brent, I think your perspective is going to be awesome, right? Because you kind of have all those different experiences, right, that kind of have shaped your career. And I think that'll be very, very valuable to our listeners. So we're going to jump right in just so that we put a perspective, because it does take a little bit of time for the recording to come out. We're sitting here at the end of October. So this is as of that particular point in time. If big things happen after that, we don't know about them today.
Things are moving fast. So that's probably
call out. Yeah, just kind of level set everyone. But really want to get your perspective in terms of the investing landscape. Like, we just had our Venture Pulse come out that kind of shows, you know, VC investments are up, right? They're up kind of across the globe. They're up in the United States compared to last year. Now, last year, we know that last year wasn't great, but still they're up, right? So what's your perspective, especially because your fund kind of plays across the spectrum? How are you feeling about things? How are you feeling about deals and, you know, the types of companies that are out there that are quote unquote investable?
You know, to your point, we do have kind of an interesting perspective in that where we play in the capital markets does kind of bridge all kind of later stage venture, growth stage investors, as well as buyout. We participate in and drive deals in all three of those sectors. We work directly with GPs for liquidity needs, and we work directly with companies. So we do see a fair amount. I'd say in broad strokes, I'd say it is frothy, maybe. Maybe the way to put it. I think at the early stages of venture, it feels a little bit Tale of Two Cities-like. You see companies getting funded without product, and some who have scaled to, say, $1 million or $3 million of ARR in a very short period of time and achieving massive valuations that imply, you know, rocket ship growth over the next year. And look, there's rationale for investing that way. When you're a power law investor, it works. We are not power law investors. We focus, on solid returns and a reasonable duration. I think in the growth stages and in kind of classic buyout in tech, at least, good companies attract capital. I think at our stages in particular, you're looking deeply at the team, because that's really the most consistent historical and future predictor of how things will turn out. And in particular, these days, like their ability to react to market pressures that may have been unpredictable like a year ago or 6 months ago. And, how can a team respond, whether it's through their messaging and positioning, through their product, through their balance sheet effectiveness, to those pressures. And by the way, in tech, particularly in software, you better have a pretty good AI story. As cliche as that sounds, it's true.
It's hands down, right? It's cross.
Yeah, I mean, it is a real. It is a real step function of change that it causes both, you know, it's fear and anxiety, but also pie in the sky for investors. So, and it's sometimes it's hard to predict, right? Even at any of those stages. So it can be tricky to tell that story, but you've got to be able to do it pretty well.
No, that makes a lot of sense. How are you guys as a firm kind of, you know, managing, like you mentioned, right? You've got to be able to react to things that you didn't see coming. You know, just given all the change that has happened in the last, say, 9 months, 9+ months, I guess, at this point. But just how are you thinking about that as a firm? You know, just those economic uncertainties, and does that impact, you know, how you invest, the types of companies you look at, any of that?
Yeah, you know, on the margin, it definitely influences what we look at. But at the same time, you know, one of the benefits of private equity is its duration, right? Like we are not public equity investors where, you know, a news clip can change its market cap, you know, can
overnight.
Have a company's market cap overnight. So in a lot of ways, we can sometimes bridge those news cycles, even economic cycles. Although obviously we remain focused on the fundamentals of the company. So like, is there a tariff? How does that impact unit economics? How does that impact growth? Where are the company's vectors of risk? Definitely have to remain keyed into all of that. That said, great companies can bridge gaps like that. And so I think you really have to remain disciplined at looking at the fundamentals and really not being overly swayed by kind of the day-to-day news cycles, though obviously keeping those things in mind, in particular, like the trajectory of those things, right? Like what happens today may, you know, change in the next, well, tomorrow or the next month or the next quarter. But what's the, you know, longer term trajectory? Like what are the true secular drivers of a company? And I think that's, so you just really have to dig into that. And there are times where it makes sense to kind of pull back a little bit and maybe concentrate on sectors that are maybe a little more defensive in nature.
Sure. Right?
And not cyclical. And one could argue now's one of those times.
That's great perspective. If I go back to deal making, so I always like to give our listeners some tidbits, right? Some little tidbits that they can take away and say, okay, I'm not going to do that. I am going to do that. Any stories that you can give the listeners of things that companies, again, without going into specifics in terms of who the company was, but things that have been good and things that have been bad that, again, just for our listeners to learn, okay, you know, these are some takeaways specifically as I look to my next round of financing, et cetera.
Yeah. Oh, geez. I've got a lot of scar tissue.
I figured you would.
Yeah. Where do I start? No, look, on the early stages, I mean, this principle carries through, you know, the entire life cycle of a company. But man, like true product discipline is very difficult in any stage of a company. It is particularly difficult today in like a new world of AI and your ability to build quickly.
Right.
It is very easy to get distracted. And it's also very hard to, you know, my last company, it was very typical for us to go sell, you know, we first start off very much product-led growth company, like direct a company, a customer could sign up in seconds on the website and start using our product. And it was great and had real customers, real revenue. We were AI driven. So like, you know, the cost structure is different than typical SaaS, right? Like API drive your COGS. And so you're sitting there thinking about, okay, well, how do I balance this? Like, how do I price this? How do I package it? All of that matters. But more fundamentally, it's like, well, where are the economics going to come from in an efficient way to drive firm growth? And we moved up market. And what I found in trying to market and sell like AI product, because AI is so flexible, it is just a consistent battle in sales with,
sure,
with what you can do and what the customer wants, and like your ability to imagine and even think like, oh, we could do that.
Yeah.
It's so tempting. And maintaining discipline and maintaining your niche and like not increasing the scope. I mean, my first company, like we built way too much too fast, like classic problem. And, you know, it hurt us in our capital raises, hurt us later, like hurt dilution, like all the things, right? Much more disciplined in my second one, but it was also like, well, it was also, you know, you've really got to pick a niche early and stick to it. And when, you know, as the company grows and gets bigger, you know, a little later life cycle, it feels like maybe you wouldn't have to worry about that as much. But I think this same kind of dilution, you know, if you think about it as both economic dilution from like a go-to-market and unit economics perspective, but also just like product dilution, everything else, like it's real. And you have to really maintain. I think it's a hard thing to do in today's market with AI as a tool.
That's really, really helpful. And I can see how, like you said, you can create so fast and you want to make your customers happy. That can really get you unfocused quickly. What about...
Yeah. I mean, anything's possible, right? And it's just...
Yeah, that's right.
Things feel like magic, right?
Yeah,
they can be deeply distracting.
Snap your fingers and there you go. But then you have to have the sales and marketing and all the other disciplines along with it. Maybe just to kind of pull on that thread just a little bit more in terms of like now on the flip side, when you're an investor, what are some mistakes that some teams have made or some companies have made where you actually think the company itself and the product is very, very much investable, but they did X or they did Y and are like, nope, we're out?
I'm not sure it's quite that black and white. Like it's rarely is it one event. Right. But it's very commonly like a pattern of, you know, we're a little later stage. Right. So look, I think it's very difficult to invest, seed, pre-seed, even A right now. I think it's very hard. Hats off to those folks. Being a little later stage than that, like we can see patterns and it is typically just it shows up, right? Patterns of execution versus, you know, a lack thereof. And, you know, as much as we all love cool things, revenue and cash. Like it is revenue and cash. This is an economic model. There's a real business model of what we have to do. And that leads to sometimes, you know, hard trade-offs. Like, you know, one thing I see that's, again, I think it's always been there, but it's becoming, I think it's just as hard now, maybe harder than it's ever been, is like truly what is your niche? Like, who are you telling your story to? It is, this was one mistake I made in my last company. It's like, we had a product, we were working to build kind of an AI chief of staff, like which ingested unstructured data from emails and Zoom and Google Meet and all these conversations and started to like coordinate teams. That's great. Good vision. We were maybe a little early, but my inability to be like totally clear, I own this. My inability to pick, say, a vertical early hurt us in the long run.
Okay.
And I think that pattern will just continue to repeat itself. It is very difficult to build a deep AI product or really any software these days, because it's just call it software. Like there is no like non-AI software anymore. There shouldn't be the big red flag if there's no AI story these days. Like those use cases are so deep and so specific. You almost can organize a company. Think of the way a company is organized, right? You have product and engineering and marketing and product marketing and sales and finance and ops and like all these different, you know, lanes. And within each lane, you have junior people, like less junior, like all the way up to the executive.
Yeah.
And if you think about that as a matrix, like each of those boxes will be picked off by an agent, by AI over time.
Right.
And eventually be able to like hand off one to the next, and like that kind of agentic workflow is very difficult to do horizontally across right. those functions. But also, like, if you multiply that by like an oil and gas company versus a software company versus right. consumer products company, like those
very
are
very different.
So it's like, yeah. It brings questions to my mind when I see big vertical apps. I'm like, oh, like, is this going to work?
Yeah. How,
like,
is that going to work?
Is it
yeah.
really going to work? Like, and when you see really tight use cases, that's awesome. But it's like, okay, geez, but what's the TAM for, like,
yeah. Oh, you know, absolutely.
It's hard. It's a really tricky time right now in a lot of ways.
Well, 100%, right? Because your customer is changing every day. So again, like, not only just the industry, right? But even within an industry, right? Your customers could be very different depending on what your product is, right? Like, and like you said earlier, like, the change is so fast, right? And that's where, like, I imagine to the Venture Pulse that I mentioned that we just released for Q3, you know, there's still obviously a very significant amount of investment in AI, but at some point, right, it has to consolidate, like, there has to be some level of consolidation slash, like, I don't know. I don't think you can continue to multiply forever, but what are your thoughts on that? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a slowdown in the amount of investing in it. That's for sure.
Yeah. You mean from funds or from, like, say, CapEx?
The companies themselves, right? At some point, they've got to start to, I would think, merge and, you know, because you've got all these different capabilities out there and all, I don't know, like you said, it moves so fast. There's just so many companies that are doing so many different things.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
You know, there will be winners. There's no doubt about that. You know, in a lot of ways, I think about AI now very similar to, like, chips and processors of the 70s and 80s. Like, you can only have so many chip manufacturers, right? Like, the CapEx involved is just astronomical. And fast forward now, I think it's very similar to, like, the foundational models. That said, every computer company, you know, mobile phone, mobile device, they all use chips, cars, everything else, right? So same thing with foundational models. The question is, like, what's the experience you're building on top of them? And there's always winners. And, you know, I think there's still a question around how deep a company's tech really is. Like, there's what feels like an age old argument at this point, though it's maybe 24 months old, is like, is it a wrapper, LLM wrapper, or is it like deep tech? And still, like, well, the question is, like, what I consult a lot of, you know, my early stage friends and founders is, like, don't be afraid of building a wrapper at the 0 to 1 phase. Like, there's no need for you to go, you know, spend a bunch of money on, you know, on NVIDIA chips and try to build, like, build a wrapper, prove product market fit, and then go raise the capital required to go deep.
Yeah.
Right? But you've got to be able to tell that story, right? Yeah. And then at the growth stages, it is absolutely true at every stage nowadays. Like, you used to be able to maybe skimp by on being undercapitalized. And I do think there are massive efficiencies that have been introduced to the market around code and even sales from an agentic perspective, but you must be fully capitalized right now, or you and able to invest, you will not be able to compete.
Yeah.
You just won't, because the teams, the competition out there is lightning fast. You got just like a bunch of cracked founders out there, just like sprinting, and you may not see them, but they're definitely there, and they are good, very good.
That's exciting and scary all at the same time. I'm going to switch gears on us just a little bit, because I want your take on the IPO market and just kind of, you know, we've had some recent podcasts, actually two in the last 6 months, with NASDAQ and their pipeline, and, you know, the IPO market is doing pretty good again as of the end of October. Just to level set everyone, what are your thoughts on the IPO market, et cetera?
Yeah, look, I think, like everybody, breathing a bit of a sigh of relief. Like, it's very, very healthy, very good to have a functioning capital markets.
Like, yeah.
you know, and in particular, you know, late stage equity capital markets, it is really the engine that drives early stage deal flow in a lot of ways. Like, you have to understand what the path to liquidity is. In fact, I'd say in a lot of ways, it's a bit of a change, at least in my perspective, over the last 5 years or so, is it has become tangibly obvious to every VC and growth equity investor there, like, their job is not just to invest in cool stuff. It is like to return capital to shareholders. It's real. It's a business model, and you are there to generate returns for your LP, period, full stop. And yeah. So like, we're seeing, you know, VCs becoming much more active managers, like at year 4, 5, 6 into a company, they start thinking about risk and exposure and like, okay, what's our upside here? Like, can we sell off? So as a secondary investor, it's, you know, we work directly with GPs and work hard to be that kind of trusted partner who can help solve those liquidity challenges, whether it's to help them recycle faster or return capital to their LPs.
Yeah.
That functioning's area of the capital stack is really important, as is the functioning IPO market. I think everybody's grateful that that's returning. I'd love to see, like, it's still a pretty high bar. Like, you got to be a real company to trade well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, what that means is still, you know, very nerve-wracking, I think, for a lot of founders. And your executives, you know, and their investors. It's like, well, you know, how is this thing actually going to trade? Like, you know, what is our narrative, our story? You will never have a harder, you know, financial introspection and like business model deep dive in your life, right? It's very
every difficult. Single quarter.
Yeah, every yeah. quarter. But yeah. yeah, especially though, like leading up to the IPO. I mean, I hadn't been in investment banking and been involved in IPOs you know, it's hard. It's very hard and deservedly. But, you know, I would like to see more companies go public. I think, you know, not purely for this reason, but like I find it unfortunate that the majority of our economy cannot and does not participate in like the exponential or at least geometric growth stages of a company.
By the time
retail investors get involved, we've got like a mature company, which is great, you know, but those returns are going to private equity folks, which, to be clear, like our LPs are pensions and, you know, money does make its way to, you know, normal people for sure.
Right.
But it's, you know, I like people focusing on capital markets. I like retail, like learning the stories of companies. Like, I think there's something really exciting about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, last question. So what are your predictions? So again, end of October, we sit today, obviously, you know, based on the information that we have as of today, what are your thoughts on, you know, what the kind of the investing landscape will continue to look like just for the rest of the year, maybe into early 26? And then also, just because I have you and I can ask, do you, what are your thoughts on the equity markets the rest of the year? I know that people get a little quieter, right, during the holidays, et cetera, but I'm kind of selfishly, I love IPOs, right? So I'm selfishly hoping that maybe there'll be a little more traction than normal because there was so much pent up demand, right? But that might just be wishful thinking on my part.
I don't think it's wishful. I think it's grounded in a true pain that's in the market. Like, I mean, there are trillions of dollars of just hung liquidity out there. And it is like really needs to work its way through the system.
Yeah.
Between now and year end, you know, we're starting to get into a tricky period to go public. But I would say, I'm also very excited. We have several companies on that path, which is great.
Oh, awesome. That's great.
And I You know, I think there are obviously risks that are out there. Like, you know, geopolitical risks are real. We have had a few yeah. solutions come down, which are phenomenal.
Yes.
On the global stage, we could use a few more within America itself and in our own economic future. You know, I do think there's some trickiness around jobs at the current state, and like, what does that mean for Jerome Powell and friends and rates. It's been a shockingly resilient, resilient economy.
Absolutely.
And it's been almost creepy, right? Because you're like, well,
yes.
I feel nervous. Why does nobody else feel nervous? Right?
Right.
Like, but man, the consumers really hung in there and companies have too, and earnings continue to perform, if not outperform. And it's hard not to feel like optimistic, but my day-to-day hat and what I see around me is sometimes feels a little different, right? I mean, I have three kids. I spend an ungodly amount of money every week on groceries. And I'm just like, unbelievable. Like,
me too. My kids are in different states, but the grocery bill is real.
You know, and that's real, right? I mean, that's real. And, you know, in some ways I wish that things like government shutdown, like it is starting to get to the point now where that will start to be felt by real people every single day.
Yeah.
We need to be able to figure out how to solve those types of things, because it will have economic impact, you know, at some point. So those are things that I'm aware of. I think the equity markets are, you know, I'm grateful for so many great companies out there that have resulted in you know, my portfolio growing, and I think many other people feel the same way. And there are some positions that I have that I'm like, geez, is this priced? But I'm a fundamental believer in so many of them that I think we're pretty healthy. I mean, that is there's definitely some real froth in the early stages in the AI side, but it's big bets on real growth. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, Brent, I cannot thank you enough for being on today. Any parting thoughts for our audience? Any last kind of tidbits of wisdom that you can share at the end here?
The famous saying, I actually should look up someday who said it, but like, I was just talking with my kids about this. So in fact, my kid mentioned it to me, which I was just so happy about.
That's great. A proud dad moment.
I don't think I'd ever mentioned it to them, but like somehow it came up and now I'd say it like every day again. And it really is just like you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Yeah, absolutely.
I believe in taking risk. Like my career shows that, for good or bad. I believe in taking risk, and I've been optimistic about the future, and I hope other people are too. Like, take risks, like push yourself, push your companies. Like we are in one of the most magnificent times to be a builder and an investor. So let's all just go get them.
Perfect. I love it. We will end on that note, Brent. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
for your
Erica.
Time. And can't wait to, hopefully, I think we got you on the hook for the Growth Capital Advisory Committee. If not, you can tell me later whether or not you're willing to help us out. But I really look forward to working with you in the future. And thank you so much for your time. And just couldn't say thank you enough.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to KPMG's Privately Speaking podcast. And be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.